So we have Kaneko on the harmonium we'll be singing, we have Ketan on the drums and Mardanga, and Samyao on the guitars. So a big round of applause for them, please. We're just moving on to the second part and the most exciting part of our event this morning. So we have a special guest today, His Holiness Bhakti Rasamrita Swami. Just a brief introduction on him. He is a monk, a lifestyle and motivational strategist, and also a community builder. He was born in India, and he completed his Bachelor of Engineering and MBA in the Universities of India. And this placed him in a very high managerial position in a multinational bank. But deeply inspired by the teachings of Bhakti Yoga and the teachings of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, he dedicated his life to propagate this message and the timeless wisdom from the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhakti Rasamrita Swami is especially known for his cutting insight into problems of today, and his talks in multinational companies in England, Russia, India, and also in Australia, best destinations. So today he will be speaking on the topic, which is not on the screen, the environmental crisis is really a spiritual crisis. And he's actually well positioned to speak about this topic because as part of his greater worldwide projects, one of his projects is the eco-friendly village in India, which lives by the principle of simple living and higher thinking. And he's actively involved in developing a self-sufficient eco-village where they strive to keep the carbon footprint to zero. We all know that the carbon, the global warming is because of greenhouse gases, but today hopefully we can allow Swami to enlighten us as to how this will actually be a spiritual crisis. So without further ado, if you can all give Swami a big round of applause, and we'll let Swami enlighten us today.
శ్రీమతే భక్తి వేదాంత స్వామి నిధి నామిని నమస్తే సారస్వతే దేవే గౌరవాణి ప్రచారిణి నిర్విశేష శూన్యవాది పాశ్చాత్య దేశకారిణి వాంఛాతరూప్యశ్చ కృపాసింధుభ్య ఏవ చ పతితానాం పావనేభ్యో వైష్ణవేభ్యో నమో నమః జయ శ్రీ కృష్ణ చైతన్య ప్రభు నిత్యానంద శ్రీ అద్వైత గదాధర శ్రీవాసాది గౌర భక్తవృంద హరే కృష్ణ 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 హరి హరి
హరే రామ 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 హరి హరి
హరే కృష్ణ. Very happy to be with you this morning. It's a bright, warm, pleasant Sunday morning. The weather has been changing. And people say it's global warming, or they say it's climate change, whatever be the reason. It reminds me of a lot of England, because the weather changes so fast. And I joke sometimes that you should spell weather as W-H-E-T-H-E-R. because you don't know whether it's going to be cool or warm or it's going to rain. And at least here you have a good weather forecasting system, so it's fine. In India also it's good, but in the opposite way. So if they tell you it's going to rain, then you keep your umbrella behind. If they say it's going to be a dry day, then carry your umbrella. But I think here the forecasts are pretty good, I'm told. Yes? So our topic for today is the environmental crisis is really a spiritual crisis. We're all aware of the environmental crisis. I think that doesn't need much elaboration. And everyone today is more and more acutely aware of how we have really ruined the environment. There isn't a planet B, although now efforts are going on to have trips to Mars and perhaps colonize a few other planets, etc. But the point is that even if we did succeed in colonizing these other planets, hypothetically, we would repeat the same thing there. Whatever good is there on the planet will be ruined as well. That's the nature human beings are. That's the way human beings are. We take something good, and when we leave behind something else that's not so good. So if our mentality and our consciousness doesn't change, then no matter where we are, whether it's a planet Earth or a planet B or a C, we're going to repeat the story. So therefore, there's something fundamentally wrong with the way the human psyche or the consciousness is. And that needs to be addressed. You know, we have symptomatic problems, and then you have the problems that are the real problems, the core, the root of the problems. When you have a disease, it's one thing to get symptomatic relief. You have a tummy ache or you have a headache. All right, you take a little something and cure it. But if there's something underlying and you don't address that, then that's not really going to solve the problem. It'll recur. You know, something like a fire alarm ringing, and then you smash the fire alarm because it's so irritating. The fire alarm is ringing, so it's making so much noise, just break it. So you break the fire alarm and there's peace. The alarm doesn't ring anymore. There's some other crisis that's there looming, and that's the fire. The fire has started somewhere. We don't know where it is. And because we've broken the fire alarm and think now we're peaceful with no noise, we're going to be consumed by a bigger fire, a bigger problem later on. So similarly, there are a variety of problems in the world. The environmental problem is only one type of problem, although it is consuming our attention a lot these days, and of course understandably. But that's not the only problem we face. Look at any sphere of human activity, whether it's sociological. Consider the relationships between people. Two people can hardly get along with each other for long these days. Am I right? Hardly. So there's some problem here. Families are breaking up, relationships break up, and people know when they enter into a relationship, it's not going to last long, so anyway you prepare for the inevitable. It doesn't have to be like that. There's lack of trust amongst people, that sense of togetherness, that unity, that sense of love and respect amongst people. You know, it doesn't seem to be the same as it was before. But of course, the material world has always had problems. So it's not that these are entirely new things. It's just that the magnitude of these things has increased to such a degree as to make it a real acute problem. And it's been evolving over time. So look at it sociologically, look at it in terms of the family unit, in terms of relationships between people, look at it psychologically in terms of the mental health of people. Do you know the number one health problem in the world? Which is the number one health problem?
The mental?
Mental health problem. It's not so much ischemic heart disease or whatever else. It's actually mental well-being. And I see this everywhere where I travel, that people are just not mentally, emotionally balanced these days. Many people. And that's the reason they can't get into a relationship with anybody for long. The level of tolerance, the level of the capacity to adjust with others, you know, the spirit of sacrifice which is necessary in any relationship, anywhere. You know, these finer values of the human spirit are somehow getting eroded. So therefore we see that psychologically also people are really not together. And because many times they grew up in broken homes, they're psychologically or emotionally malnourished. So they're not emotionally well-rounded when they grow up. So they have so many issues. And I see this practically all the time, everywhere, despite all our economic advancement, our technological advancement, our military prowess, our sophistication of the way we live and so on. Despite all of this, something is amiss. Something is wrong. We are not happier than we used to be. And that's the statement that can be debated, of course, there may be others who have other points of view, but it's quite obvious, it seems to me, that we're not as happy as our previous generation used to be. They had less in material terms. They had simpler lives in material terms. They were not as sophisticated in material terms, but they were satisfied. They could get along better with others than we do now. They also have their problems. But if you look at the history of how people have moved, it's getting worse and worse and worse. So what is the problem? The problem lies somewhere. If we're going to address every problem only superficially, we'll only address the symptoms of the problem. So one of the huge problems that has blown up now is the environmental crisis. And we sometimes do not comprehend the gravity of the whole thing. And we sometimes do things which we think are eco-friendly, but actually they aren't so. For example, you know, we talk about paperless offices, yes? Isn't that something very common now? And isn't that considered to be an eco-friendly thing? Is it really eco-friendly? I ask you this question. What do you think? Are paperless offices necessarily eco-friendly? Let's take an office of 50 years ago where they didn't have electronic gadgets and computers and everything. So they had to have paper. And now we have paperless offices, at least a move towards being completely paperless. And one of the main motivating factors is that we use less paper, we cut fewer trees, and therefore it's eco-friendly. But is that really so? Any thoughts on this? Is a paperless office necessarily more eco-friendly than one with paper? Yes? How many say yes? That a paperless office is more eco-friendly? How many say yes? Okay, how many say no, that a paperless eco-friendly office is not as eco-friendly as others? No. How many undecided? Okay. Actually, in my view, it's not. We're only looking at the superficial use of paper. Of course, it is true that you've got trees, but then it's renewable. You could ensure that you use paper which is replaced, recyclable. And there are many people doing these good things now. You could plant more trees and ensure that you can plant as many trees as you cut, or more than that perhaps. So it's possible that by using paper you could still preserve the environment, and also you ensure that you don't waste paper, etc. So there is some degree of eco-friendliness there. But look at the modern day setup where you use computers, laptops and mobile phones and so on. And we think because we're not using paper, we're eco-friendly. But the shelf life of these gadgets is getting lower and lower because there are newer and newer models coming up. The older ones get updated. And we very rarely think about what happens to the gadgets when we dispose of them. This is the elephant in the room nobody wants to see. And if you look at the way China is, it imports all these used gadgets. They of course churn out the manufactured ones also. And then they take back all the junk that we throw. Imagine the whole world, how much must it be consuming in terms of electronic gadgets, phones and everything. First of all, how much does it take and what does it take to make a single mobile phone? Is it eco-friendly? Is a mobile phone eco-friendly? Is a laptop eco-friendly? It's made of all sorts of plastics and other things, which are products of industries, of chemicals and polymers and all sorts of things, which produce pollution. We don't see it being manufactured, so for us we just get a slick instrument and we think it's eco-friendly. So for the production of these items, what kind of environmental degradation and havoc happens? We don't see that, and it's not talked about. When we use these instruments, what kind of environmental pollution happens of the space of the ether with all this radiation all around? Can we even imagine the kind of radiation our bodies are subjected to now? We don't think about it. We have all these, the internet and internet waves and radio waves and television waves and the mobile phone networks beaming waves and waves, so much radiation going on. Unlimited. If we were to have eyes to see all of this, we would get blinded completely. But we can't see those frequencies. So ignorance is bliss, so we think we're quite fine and we're eco-friendly. So the pollution of the ether by the use of such electronic gadgets, and then when we dispose of these gadgets, then what happens? We just throw it away somewhere and we forget about it. Use and throw. What happens after that? We don't know. And that's the catch. Where does it get disposed of? Into the earth. There are landfills in various other places. It goes to countries that are poorer because they need the money. So they import it, they get money to do that, and they just dump it somewhere. There was a film I saw many years ago. I think it was called The Story of Stuff. Have you heard that? Heard of this film? It's called The Story of Stuff. What happens to all the stuff that we use? So the point is, it's enormously damaging to the environment. The only solution now is to send all these off into outer space, just crush them, send them off into outer space, and let it be going to some other galaxy or something like that. At least it's such a vast space that pollution won't be so noticeable. But here on Earth, what are we doing? With all our technological advancement, we still want our cars. Even with all the eco-friendly cars, yes, ultimately what happens after a few years, we dispose of the cars. And then what happens? They add to the environmental problem of the world. So no amount of tinkering and tampering at the superficial level is going to help. We really have to go very deep to understand what the current problems are due to. What are the causes? And the very title of our talk today says that the environmental crisis is really a spiritual crisis. But before we go further, we must clarify our terms. What do we mean by the word spiritual? It is a crisis. What does it connote, the word spiritual? Well, you could understand it in different ways and different people could define it differently. I would give some very simple definitions of the word spiritual. I would say spirituality has a few dimensions. Number one, spirituality involves understanding our own spiritual identity. Number one. Number two, it involves understanding the source, the ultimate source of ourselves and of the world in which we live. Is there an ultimate source, or has it all come about by chance? Is it just a big bang? Is it just something that exploded and made this entire beautiful creation? Or is there a source? So do we have an ultimate source? And does the world around us, the environment, have an ultimate source? To identify that, understand it. That's the second aspect of spirituality. The third aspect is to act according to that understanding. As in point number two. So I'll repeat the 3 points. Number one, to understand, to know and understand our true spiritual identity. Number two, to know and understand the original, ultimate source of not only ourselves, but of the world around us. And number three, to act according to this understanding. So spirituality is the process by which we know ourselves, we know the source of everything, and we also know the world around us in that vision. It is not a matter of simply some narrow, parochial, sectarian definition of some particular faith or belief. All the religion of God definitely are important parts of the whole scheme of things. But for far too long have we divided humanity on the basis of parochial distinctions. Because you're born in a certain family or a certain community or a certain faith or a certain nationality or a certain ethnicity, we divide each other. A spiritual understanding will take us beyond that. So the first thing about spirituality is to understand that we are not material. We are not this body. We are eternal spiritual sparks. The Bhagavad Gita speaks about this as a very fundamental teaching. When you start reading the Bhagavad Gita, that's the first thing you learn. That we are not this body. We are the eternal spirit soul. We are spiritual, which means we are not destructible. We are imperishable. The body is destroyed, but the soul is not destroyed. We are a particle of spiritual energy. Now, we don't have any experience or conception of the spiritual energy in the everyday world directly. Indirectly, we do, because wherever we see life, it means there is spirit, there is spiritual energy underlying it. Otherwise, matter is dead. Matter by itself, let's say this microphone, is dead. We can make it work when there is a living entity that actually makes it work, that fashions it into this shape, takes some minerals and metals and so many products, items, ingredients, and through some industrial process makes this thing and then utilizes it, it needs a current and so on. Then we use it. So even when we see inanimate things, one can understand that there is some spiritual force, there is some life force behind it. So that is the way we see ourselves, and we understand all life to be like that. That all life is spiritual. Do you know how they define death in the law? At least in India and England, I know it about how they define it here in Australia. Any lawyers here by any chance? The definition of death, very interestingly, is the absence of life. them, what is life? That's not different. And that's the big question. What is life? And modern medicine defines life in terms of chemicals, electrochemical reactions going on in the brain. And so when you are, so you're a doctor, right? So you define death in terms of brain depth or brain stem depth and such definitions, right? You look at the EEG and the brain waves no longer are flat, they're flat. Yeah? So you're looking at the symptoms of lack of life, correct? But you're not looking at life. Medical science doesn't quite understand and explain what life is. They can understand when there is no life or when there is life. They can understand the symptoms of life, but they do not understand life. And they think life is just a combination of chemicals and atoms and molecules. And all the emotions and feelings and everything that we experience are just electrochemical processes taking place in the brain. And they identify certain parts in the brain that correlate. So there's a certain part of your brain that has to do with, let us say, anger. Another part that has to do with love. Another part that has to do with some other emotion. So they do experiments and they stimulate that portion of the brain. And then the person gets angry. And they say, yes. So they believe that anger is a neurochemical reaction coming from that part of the brain. But it's not just like that. Otherwise, human beings would be just like robots, just like machines, which you can stimulate and give some impetus and then it acts in a certain way. But human beings are much more. All life living entities are much more than just machines. Because living entities have experience. A computer may be able to identify red color and black color through certain cameras and software and so on. But can it get the experience of seeing that color? When you sit on the seaside and enjoy the sunrise or the sunset, a machine or a computer can also recognize and type out the sun is setting. And it can be programmed to say, what a beautiful sunset it is. But does the computer actually experience that? But the human being is sitting there and experiencing the beauty of that sunset. So this experience, this emotion is something that cannot be explained away just by chemicals and atoms. So the first step in spirituality is to know that we are spiritual beings. I think it was Mark Twain or somebody like that who said that we are not human beings who have a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings who are now having a human experience. So the spirit soul is now in a human body. Previously it may have been in some other kind of body, and after this body is destroyed it could be yet another type of body. So the soul moves from body to body to body. And the experience changes along with that. So this is the first step, that we are spiritual entities. At least theoretically to understand that is important. And then the next step is to see where do we come from? Where does this spiritual entity come from? Everything has a source. Where has this world come from? So the ideas of Big Bang, etc., don't seem to make very sublime logical sense because there are many fundamental questions that come up. What happened before the Big Bang? What existed before the Big Bang? What was it that sparked off the Big Bang? What was inside whatever the whatever it was that exploded? How is it that an explosion causes such harmony and beauty and order and precision in nature? These are fundamental questions which science cannot answer. So there is some other explanation. So the second point of spirituality is to understand the source of not just of ourselves as spiritual entities, but also of this inanimate matter. The material world in which we live, our entire environment, is a combination of the material and the spiritual. there is the material body of the trees, of the insects, of the birds, of the animals, of the human beings. And then there are these spirit souls that drive the body or make it exist and survive. So even a plant has certain life symptoms. By capillary action, the plants, the trees suck up water from the roots, and the water goes up into and nourishes all the plants, the leaves and the twigs and so on. So, but that will not happen when the soul leaves the tree's body. When the tree is dead, that will not happen. So the tree functions in its own way when the soul is present in the body. The human body functions when the soul is existing within it. When the soul leaves, we call it death. So whether it's animate matter or inanimate matter, or rather animate entities or inanimate matter, it has a source. So the second dimension of spirituality is to understand, to first of all inquire and then understand what that source is. Please remember, we are talking of something that goes beyond parochial definitions of my faith and your faith. And the third aspect of spirituality is to understand and act according to whatever we have learned in step one and step two. Otherwise, it's just book knowledge. We have to actually walk the talk. We have to experience it. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. So it's not just the philosophy, but it's also the practice of that philosophy or the ideology that's very important. So now, look at the modern day world or the world in general throughout history. Generally, it has been characterized by materialism, and that has grown excessively in the modern day. Materialism is the exact opposite of spiritualism. So the first dimension of spirituality was to understand that we are spiritual entities, but materialism says, no, there's nothing like spiritual. This is all, mumbo-jumbo, it's all sentimental, irrational stuff. Actually, we're just chemicals and atoms and molecules and electrochemical impulses and so on. So that's the first difference. Materialism, this is the predominant philosophy today. Most people today believe this. So science has become the new religion today, actually. And the scientists are the new prophets. So it's no different, really. So for all the accusations against spiritual paths and religion, etc., but science is exactly the same. If religion is accused of dogma, science is no less dogmatic. And for those of you who are familiar with the way science works and the way research happens and the way theories are made and changed, etc., or not changed when they should, then I'm sure you'll be familiar, you'll be aware of what I'm speaking about. So that's the first point about our identity, the difference between the spiritual approach and the material approach. The second point of spirituality which I mentioned was the ultimate source of everything. Because we are spiritual and there's also matter, and the ultimate source of everything is also spiritual, because spirit is superior to matter. Matter comes from spirit. Spirit cannot come from matter, because spirit is conscious, sentient. So it is superior to dead matter. It needs spirit to organize matter and to make a pattern, to make it produce something, to make it work. So there is a supreme spiritual source for spirit as well as matter. So that is the second dimension of spirituality, but materialism doesn't accept that. Materialism says there is no supreme source like this. And I was reading one book by one Nobel winning laureate many years ago. I forget the name of that author now. I still remember it was a red colored book. It was called The Necessity of Chance, that I remember. And he says in that book that the only dogma that scientists allow themselves is the belief that the conviction there is no God. I mean, we are clear. This one thing we cannot include, you know, whatever may happen. This is our dogma, no God. Period. This is non-negotiable for us. But what if your scientific research were to progress in such a way that it pointed inevitably to something that was the source of everything else? But he said, no, that's our dogma, we can't touch it. So if you mention the very word God, that is, you know, that is, then you become a persona non grata. You're no longer part of the scientific community. You're not scientific anymore, you're irrational, you're illogical, etc., etc., you're backward, and other such colorful phrases. So materialism is the opposite of spiritualism in this respect also. And the third aspect of spirituality is action, how we act on the basis of understanding steps 1 and 2. You act in a spiritual way. And what it is, I'll come to very shortly. So you act with this understanding that I'm a spiritual entity and that there is an ultimate spiritual source of everything and we have a connection. And I must act in accordance with that connection. So that will be a very holistic way of acting. It will be something that is very, shall we say, complete. It will be non-disruptive. It will be pleasing, harmonious. On the other hand, because in materialism, you have the first two steps where there is no spiritual entity, it's just matter. And the second one, there's no source of anything. So then one's actions are also done accordingly. So if there is no source of everything, we are not spiritual entities, then what is the purpose of life? There is a meaninglessness there to life. Then there is no understanding that life has any meaning at all. So life is just a chance occurrence anyway, as they say. So everything has happened by chance. Life also originated by a random combination of chemicals and molecules when there was some favorable setup. Some spark came up and then some molecules formed and they formed more complex molecules like amino acids. Eventually they formed proteins and the proteins formed the DNA and the RNA. They formed then the cell and then the cells formed tissues and the tissues formed organs and the organs form a particular body. So this way the living entities evolve from the most simple, elementary, unicellular organisms like the amoeba and so on, and right up to the complex human being. That is their theory. So with a view like that, what purpose does life have? There is no meaning to life, there is no purpose to life. So there is a vacuum. So we have to devise some sense of purpose. So therefore we have so many theories. And in any case, so we say, well, we're just born and we die, and in this interval, let's enjoy ourselves. So it gives rise to a philosophy of hedonism. Hedonism means you just eat, drink, and be merry. What does it matter anyway? And then when you're a little more enlightened than that, you say, yes, eat, drink, and marry, but don't cause harm to others. So that's a slightly evolved form of the same thing. But essentially, it's the same thing. All you're doing is you're being a little considerate, that's all. You just want to see that others are not harmed in the process of you enjoying your life. So enjoyment of this world is a fundamental principle of materialism. And the nature of the human mind that is untrained in spiritual matters is that the spirit of enjoyment grows and it is very hard to repress it, to control it. It's called lust. By lust we mean any desire to exploit, any desire to enjoy anything else. We speak of the word lust in a very general sense. So the word lust characterizes materialism because you want to enjoy and exploit the resources of this world. whether there are other people, whether there are things of this world, whether it's nature, we want to enjoy and exploit. That is the predominant mood that underlies and follows the theory or the principles of materialism. And when you want to enjoy, and when that is your philosophy, then you become more and more self-centered. You become more and more selfish. You become more and more concerned about yourself. Then you become more and more individualistic. Now you become more conscious of your rights than your duties. Then it's a matter of I and my freedom. It's not a question of how I will affect others in the exercise of my rights. So the idea of duties is no longer given the kind of importance that it used to. Traditional cultures all over the world have always struck a healthy balance between duties and rights, if not always, at least majorly. But today we have a philosophy of materialism that has been carried too far, and it is being taken to a level of philosophical sophistication today by various terms, where emphasis is being given excessively on rights. So human rights, it is my individual right. Rights are something precious, and every civilized society will recognize the importance of individual rights. So no civilized person should have any issue with people asking for rights. But the problem is, there is no simultaneous awareness or understanding of the need for equally focusing on our duties. It is my right to enjoy this world, so I can cut down the trees, I can drill, get oil, and I can mine coal, and I can do all this and run our power plants and run my cars, and I can fuel my house, and I can do all of this because it's for me. This world is for my enjoyment. And therefore it's quite fine, it's quite legitimate for me to exploit the resources of the world around me. So we take it as our right, but it is not our right. This is not our property. That is the point. Because materialism does not accommodate the idea of a superior ownership to the world, we do not acknowledge that this is not my right. I have been given a certain quota to enjoy. Just as in a certain office situation, there are different categories of employees, and they are all given certain duties to perform. So they have certain responsibilities. And in order to discharge those functions, they also need some facility, they need some rights also. So they're given a table or a cabin or some forms or computers or whatever else they're given. So even though an employee is given a cabin to use for himself or herself, ultimately the employee knows that this cabin belongs to the office. It's been given to me for using for the sake of the office, for furthering the objectives for this office or company has been formed for. If the employee forgets that and starts thinking, this is mine, it's my right to enjoy it, and I would use this cabin any way I like, and I'd use this office equipment any way I like, then that would be a transgression of the office rules. And one could get pulled up for it. But one doesn't think that way about the world. One doesn't think that actually this is not my property to enjoy as I wish. It is not even the property of the government to enjoy as it wishes. Because governments change, people change, rulers change, but the environment remains. Let's say in Australia, 500 years ago, there was a different setup. 200 years ago, another setup. And here you have governments changing every now and then, and even though you have the nation state, Australia, but Australia is not eternal. There was a time when Australia did not exist as a nation state. It existed as a place. So the place is there, but people come and go, and we have different arrangements to exploit the resources of nature. So now we have all these nation states all over the world where everyone thinks what's within my boundaries is my right to enjoy and exploit. Because everyone has this philosophy of materialism, of godlessness. And it is this that is the root problem. And when the enjoying spirit is not tempered by a higher spiritual awareness and practice, that sense of enjoyment would most likely go awry. It would go berserk. And that is what happens in this world. So therefore, for example, in the financial markets, you have all these crashes, the stock market crashes and so on. Why? Because greed runs amok. Some rogue stock market traders, they do all sorts of scandals there. Lots of things happen. And it causes chaos in the whole financial markets. Why? It's greed. The spirit of enjoying. I want to enjoy. We don't realize that I have a quota. And my legitimate enjoyment is restricted to my quota. But when I want to go beyond my quota, that's when problems arise. And I will be impelled to go beyond my quota because my mind is not controlled. My mind is not peaceful. My mind is full of desires for enjoyment. Because my philosophy is, it is my right to enjoy. It is the goal of my life to maximize my enjoyment in this world. So therefore we go all out and try to enjoy. Similarly with the environment. Look at the major culprits, the oil industry. How much damage has the oil industry caused? Or the drilling of holes in the drilling in the water, in the ocean bed, in the land, the mining industries, how much havoc we have caused. Even interfering with the balance of the earth. You know, many years ago, not many actually, some years ago, there was a huge tsunami in Japan. Do you remember that? And the tsunami also caused the destruction of the nuclear plant there. And the nuclear plant had to close down, and it caused radioactive contamination of that whole area. Many people died as well. There was an earthquake somewhere, and then that caused a tsunami, and the tsunami came and wreaked havoc everywhere, including in that nuclear energy plant. And I read an interesting theory written in one article by some scientist who put forward one theory. I don't know that theory is accepted by others in his field, but at least he made that theory. And I'm sure there's some merit to it. He said, because we have been digging and digging and digging into the earth, we've been upsetting the balance of the earth so much. There were trains, the underground train stations in many countries are like a couple of kilometers underground. 1 kilometer, 2, 3, 5 kilometers underground. What does it take to construct tunnels underground like that? What kind of excavation equipment and digging and drilling we have to do? And how would that affect the balance of the earth? It may not affect it in such a drastic way that the earth would fall off its orbit or something, because the earth is very big and the holes we're digging are not that big. But nevertheless, even a very subtle, slight change can create such a big difference. So this scientist wrote in this article that because they've dug all these underground cities practically, and in the course of doing that, they've created terrible disturbance in the whole balance, in the whole ecosystem. They've upset that whole delicate balance there. And so the vibrations, you know, even when you have a little ordinary drill, what kind of vibrations are there? You know, just a little drill, you know, drilling it into your wall, What kind of noise does it make? What kind of disturbance does it create in the vibrations that come? And imagine these massive, huge, earth-moving equipment and drills and that dig way into the ground. What kind of vibrations does it set off underground in the earth? How is the earth's balance affected? And so the fact that such a thing could potentially bring about instability under the earth and that could trigger off some earthquake somewhere is not an unreasonable idea. So because we want to go ahead recklessly using this world without pondering over the consequences of it, because we think that we want luxury, we want comfort, we want convenience, and we disturb the fine balance of nature. So because the enjoying spirit is unbridled, it is not controlled by a spiritual frame of mind, it goes way off, and we cut trees, we cut down forests today. How much of the forest cover in the planet has been completely denuded? In India, at least I know, it's a major problem. People have cut and just simply destroyed forests on a large scale. Everything is very delicately balanced, the ecological balance is very tender now, very tenderly poised. A slight disturbance can create havoc there. So because we have been enjoying and enjoying and exploiting, because we have no sense of duty towards the environment, we have only sense of right, entitlement. And I am entitled to enjoy this after all. Even the animals have the right to enjoy it, why only us? And what right do we have to kill those animals anyway also? So these are reflections of a spiritual mind. And as we go on further, the enjoyment increases and continues for a long period of time. It also interferes and enters into our personal relationships. Because it's me, it's all about me and my happiness and my comfort and luxury and my convenience and my independence. So if another person interferes with that even slightly, we cannot take it. We don't have that spirit of tolerance. We don't have that spirit to forgive. A spirit of adjusting with someone. A spirit of sacrifice. Without sacrifice, no civilization is possible. Without tolerance, without humbleness, no civilization is truly possible. So therefore, this ultimately the cause of all our problems is the existence of this enjoying, exploitative mentality, which comes from the underlying philosophy of materialism, which is directly opposed to spiritualism. So if you want to solve our environmental problem, since that is the topic for today, we have to change the fundamentals. We have to go deep down and accept a spiritual way of thinking. As far as the spiritual way of thinking, I already mentioned that we are spiritual entities and that there is a supreme spiritual source, the source of the spirit and the inanimate matter. So how do we see the world in connection to that supreme source? We call him Krishna. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna himself speaks that. And he says, I am the source of everything, animate and inanimate. And one who understands this surrenders unto me and serves me with love and devotion, with a full heart. This is the practice of spirituality, where we recognize our spiritual nature, we understand our source, and try to revive our relationship of love with that entity who is our source. Essentially, this is what spirituality is all about. So when we engage in such an act of love, our heart is purified of all these other exploitative tendencies, of all the negative tendencies like lust, greed, anger, envy, pride, illusion. by spiritual practices, especially devotional practices, these things are cleansed from the heart. And then one realizes, actually, everything is connected to Krishna, the original source of everything who is all attractive. Krishna means in Sanskrit all attractive. Since some people have an aversion to call him God these days, you know, you have to be careful when you say God, because some people don't like to use the word God. And we understand, because there has been so much problem with religion these days. But of course, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have to understand this term correctly. If you understand it in a broad, non-sectarian way, as a source of everything and everyone, then we have no problem here. So when we understand the supreme divinity that we call Krishna, or even call it by any other name, and when we see everything around us as emanations from Him, we see the divinity in nature. And this is the point I want to come to. A genuine spiritualist will see the divinity of nature. Which doesn't mean that we see nature as God. That's different. Sometimes people confuse this to be nature worship. No, that's different. Nature worship is when you consider nature to be supreme. But we're not considering nature to be supreme. We're saying nature is an energy of the supreme energetic Krishna. So this environment is divine because it's coming from that divine personality. So we will treat it with respect. If I respect you, then I must respect your possessions as well. Isn't it? Your house. And I respect you a lot. But when I come to your house, I just throw around your things in the house, you know, your computer, I just throw it here. And I just say, you know, it's right. And I said, but you know, I respect you. And he said, no, you've got to protest and say, that's not respect. If you respect me, you respect my computer. But don't throw it around. Because when you disrespect my computer, you are disrespecting me. If I did that to somebody else's computer, or to my own computer, perhaps you wouldn't have protested so vehemently. But because you have that affinity to that computer, so you think, yes, why are you doing this? You're disrespecting me. Our founder, Acharya, of our movement, of the Hare Krishna movement, Srila Prabhupada, one time, someone asked him this question about the nature, or nature of the environment, how we should see that, and how we can see Krishna everywhere. How can we remember Krishna everywhere, and how can we have some divine experience even by seeing nature, which is not directly the source of everything, it is an emanation, but still, how can we see things with a divine perspective? So Srila Prabhupada answered, he was sitting behind his desk, and his eyeglasses, his spectacles were lying on the table. So he asked his disciple, he said, what do you see here? He said, spectacles. So when you look at those spectacles, what do you think about? We think about you, Srila Prabhupada. So why? They're spectacles, that's not me. But why do you think of me when you look at those spectacles? Because they are your spectacles, Srila Prabhupada. He said, yes. Similarly, when you look at nature, you think of Krishna. Why? Because it's Krishna's nature. Nature is always somebody's nature. All of us have a nature. Someone has an angry nature, someone has a kind nature, someone has a loving nature. We all have our nature, so this is nature. So whose nature? It's Krishna's nature. So when we look at nature, if you realize the source is coming from Krishna, that's it. So now, why would we exploit it? Just as I wouldn't come and misuse your computer or your refrigerator and so on in your house, similarly, I wouldn't misuse and exploit nature because I know it's divine. Why is it divine? It's because it's coming from the absolute divine, Krishna. So I will treat the environment with respect. And by environment, I mean everything within the environment. The animals, the birds, all living entities, the trees, the hills, the seas, the rivers, the atmosphere, everything. So this is how we see environment of divinity. You see, today, there are many people who have realized the harmful consequences of our exploitation of nature and the environment. So they are activists, or they believe in protecting the environment. So they are very much opposed to any exploitation of the environment, which is of course very good. But the point is, it's still not a very evolved way of thinking. Because this awareness or this approach to environmental protection is utilitarian. Utilitarian means that utility oriented. It's somewhat selfish in nature. In what way? If I don't preserve the environment, what's going to happen to me? If I pollute the city around me, we have lots of vehicles which produce toxic fumes, then I'm going to have respiratory diseases. It's not good for me. So good for health, good for all of us, we should keep a clean environment. It upsets the balance, as global warming is hard for us, the ozone layer gets depleted, and we get, you know, all sorts of skin cancers. And so at heart, behind our environmental, let's say, protection, we have a utilitarian approach. It's something that I'm protecting the environment because if I don't, it's going to harm me. Well, at least it's that much better than exploiting the environment. At least out of fear, we're not doing that. That's good. But we have to move to a higher level, which is to see the divinity in things. This is actually sublime. You know, in the English language, we use the phrase Mother Nature. Are you familiar with this term? Mother Nature? So, where is Father? Isn't it a logical question? If we talk of Mother Nature, so where is Father? In a complete family, you need father and mother. Then the children are happy. They're complete. It's a complete family, generally. Of course, it's unfortunate that sometimes it may not happen for one or the other reason. But in general, it's always better, given a choice, that father and mother exist. And then everything is very nice. It's a complete family. So, another issue with our modern day environmental approach, even for those who rise beyond exploiting and realize the necessity of conserving, preserving, protecting the environment, is that we're only looking at mother, but we don't want father. So we can't have a complete family situation. So we want a holistic approach to everything. It must be Mother Nature and Father God. And then our environmental protection, our approach towards the environment will be truly complete. And when I say I speak of Father God, I don't speak in terms of my God is better than your God, and I'll kill you because you don't believe in my God. I don't speak on that platform. I speak with the understanding that this is something completely transcendental. There is one source of everything. It's not that there's a Christian source for everything, another Muslim source, another Hindu source for everything, and that these divinities are fighting in the sky somewhere. No, that's not it. Ultimately, the source of everything is one. And different religious faiths have understood this differently, and they call it differently. You may have different languages, different terminology, different conceptions, but ultimately there's one source. So when we see the environment and everything around us with respect to that one source, we will treat everything with respect and with love even. And here there is no selfish interest. And then because we are children, we have the quota. We have our quota. By our destiny, we are meant to enjoy a certain amount. Alright, so enjoy that. But don't become greedy, we are told. The spiritualist would say, don't become greedy. Don't over-exercise your rights. Don't go beyond your jurisdiction of your quota. Then your enjoyment will be within limits. You can live a happy life, enjoy pleasures in a certain limited way, in a restricted way, and the whole environment will be happy, the world will be happy. We can live together as one big family. We're all people and living entities are brothers and sisters. It's not just that the human beings are brothers and sisters. Even the animals and birds are our brothers and sisters. And this is exactly what the Vedic version is. It's called Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, that this whole earth is one family. This is the spiritual vision. Not the small-minded vision, this is mine, that's not mine, that's not yours, we'll grab from each other. No. So in the pursuit of such a holistic, sublime vision, we have to develop our understanding of ourselves as a spirit soul, of Krishna as a supreme source of everything, and of all the world around us as being also the energy of the Lord. And we have to see how everything can be converged to harmoniously serve as supreme energetic Krishna. And the fundamental way to do it is to chant the holy names. Right at the beginning we chanted the Hare Krishna Mahamantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This is a way of invoking that Divine Supreme Personality, Krishna, in sound vibration. It's called mantra meditation. So we link up to Krishna through this sublime sound vibration. And then we will see the transformation coming in our hearts. And if this becomes something that's all-pervading or all-pervasive, then imagine how we will see everything with a divine perspective. And then not just the environmental problem, but our social problems, psychological problems, economic problems, etc., will all be resolved. Thank you very much. I'm really thankful to the devotees who have organized this, Abhang, Jagannath, and who else has been involved? Okay, thank you for organizing this program, and thank you for inviting me. And I want to thank you, my dear audience, for being very gracious listeners. I haven't seen anyone nodding off to sleep. That's a testament to your intelligence and your fortitude, tolerance. Thank you very much. I think we have time for some questions. Okay. Yes.
Can I ask one question? You mentioned a couple of times, love over, love the quota.
Can you speak in the mic so that everyone can hear? Is it which one?
Is this which one?
Yes.
So you said a number of times, safety of quota, love over, love. How do you know what your quota is?
Okay, good question. You had mentioned the stick to your quota. How do you know what your quota is? First, your quota is what you have now. First, point number one. You could have more or you could have less tomorrow. But for today, this is the quota. We continue to work sincerely, ethically, in principle, but in keeping with spiritual principles, and then depend on Krishna for giving us more or taking away what we have and be satisfied with that. So if you think that you don't have a house and you're renting it and you want to buy one and you want to work towards it, so be it. So you work honestly, you work sincerely, and you plan for it. And if it works out, then yes, eventually you